to ask yourself this question. If all of the above isn't enough to prosecute or at least investigate Hillary for criminally colluding with the Russians, how can you possibly justify the ongoing investigation of President Trump, a 1.5-year investigation that has turned up no evidence at all? A major player in all this was Viktor Pinchuk, the largest individual contributor to the Clinton Foundation. Pinchuk bills steel pipes in Ukraine in violation of U.S. law. Don't forget, Special Counsel Robert Mueller was director of the FBI while all of this was going on. It was Mueller's FBI that opened the investigation into the 2012 Benghazi attack, also on Secretary Clinton's watch, that resulted in the first death of a U.S. ambassador in more than 30 years. At the very least, Secretary Clinton was guilty of an extreme dereliction of duty as her State Department denied repeated requests for additional security from Ambassador Christopher Stevens himself and other officials stationed in Benghazi in 2012. Clinton's motivation was unclear, but we know Clinton was lying through her teeth when she said the attack was born out of the spontaneous protest of a poorly made anti-Muslim video. After offering that explanation to the public shortly after 10 p.m. on the night of the attack, she emailed her daughter Chelsea at 11:12 p.m. saying the attack had been perpetrated by an al-Qaeda-like group. On a phone call the next day, Hillary admitted to the Egyptian prime minister that the attack had nothing to do with the film. Yet she went on publicly saying it did for 10 days after the attack, including while attending the return of the coffins in Delaware 2 days later. The simplest explanation is that she was simply covering for her State Department's earlier denials of requests for additional security. Or was there something else she was covering up? There was some evidence that she might have been running guns from Libya to Syria, hoping to do there what she had done in Libya, support radical jihadists to overthrow a dictator. Even as Libya descended into chaos, she couldn't seem to learn from the mistake of deposing Muammar Gaddafi and leaving a power vacuum for the jihadis to fill. 5 years later, she was still defending that decision, ignoring the chaos she had unleashed across the entire region. Whatever she might have been up to, there was one thing that was certain. The FBI's investigation wasn't going to shed any light on the matter. One consistent theme throughout the tenures of Directors Mueller and Comey was the FBI would find no wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton, no matter how much smoke poured from the barrel of the gun. And remember, this isn't because they necessarily liked Hillary Clinton. They weren't rhinos in that respect, secretly working on behalf of the Democrats. As I said at the beginning of this book, the real partisan divide isn't Democrat versus Republican. It's the swamp party versus the people. I started this timeline long after the scandals that plagued Hillary Clinton while she was first lady, and don't want to spend the time and space reviewing those here, except to point out one interesting little fact. Back in the 1990s, more than 2 decades before he became Deputy Attorney General of the United States, the man who appointed Robert Mueller's special counsel to investigate Russian interference in our elections, Rod Rosenstein, was part of another special counsel investigation. He was one of the team of prosecutors working under Kenneth Starr to investigate Bill and Hillary Clinton's Whitewater real estate scandal. The investigation found no evidence of wrongdoing by the Clintons. A foreign policy for sale. So how do I really feel? Here's what I said about Hillary before the election. Hillary Clinton would be, without a doubt, hands down, the absolute best CEO of a public company. Ruthless, profit-driven, all about the money. But if you're looking for a different kind of CEO, one to run the greatest nation on earth and bring back America, now teetering on the brink of socialism, to be president of the United States, Hillary Clinton is the worst possible choice. She is the person to run away from. She has never cared about you. This woman only cares about herself, money, her next step up the political ladder, and if president, will only care about her legacy. Her influence peddling on a global scale and the setting of American foreign policy to coincide with the flow of hundreds of millions of dollars to the corrupt Clinton Foundation and millions directly to Bill Clinton and ultimately Hillary in speaking fees has no parallel in American history. There is no question that Bill's speaking fees tripled and quadrupled when Hillary was Secretary of State. Contributors who stood to profit from Hillary's influence at the State Department looked to hire Bill. Historically, prosecutors have looked for quid pro quos from politicians when they deliver to constituents or other contributors. Politicians doing business for themselves, lining their own pockets, is the essence of public corruption. Not only were contributions to the foundation and speaking fees to Bill made, but in many of these deals, both Hillary and Bill were in the subject foreign country at the same time, wheeling and dealing. She wielding American diplomacy, he receiving speaking fees of $500,000 to $750,000, and their foundation, the huge beneficiary of hundreds of millions of dollars, some reported, some not. Prosecutors have convicted politicians for things as simple as a free cab ride in exchange for favors. It's called bribery, conspiracy, and violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Whenever an American government official accepts gifts intended to curry favor, he crosses the line. Bill and Hillary started with nothing. Bill is now the wealthiest ex-president in the United States. Might it be because Hillary greased the skids, after which Bill accepted massive gratuities? Many think we may never know, because she refuses to give up her email server. How do you go from dead broke to filthy rich? Why would you not recuse yourself as Secretary of State when there is a conflict of interest or even the appearance of one? Hillary Clinton's life has always been about money. From Whitewater to cattle futures to leaving the White House with whatever she could take. As a prosecutor, I can tell you that it's always about money or women, and the Clintons have both. When I hear things like, oh, everybody does it, I get aggravated. I am tired of people condoning corruption when it's committed by a member of their party. My back goes up when I hear that Russia, because of the Clintons, now controls a great deal of America's uranium. There is a name for people who are willing to sell out their country for cash. Chapter 8. Lying and Leaking to Fix an Election. In 2016, Andrew McCabe leaked information to the Wall Street Journal. He lied about this in congressional hearings. McCabe, I guess, never thought he would get caught. The Wall Street Journal did a follow-up story regarding McCabe's issuance of a stand-down order he issued to FBI staff who were looking into Hillary's email server. In brief, it goes like this. The FBI field office was investigating the improper use of Hillary's email server, where classified information was disseminated. McCabe heard about this while he was on a trip overseas. He then told his field office he was not happy and directed them to stand down. That is, stop the investigation of Hillary immediately. Was this another effort by FBI bosses to get Hillary elected? Do you think? Hillary received significant cooperation from her longtime deep state friends in the DOJ and FBI. Changing of the Deep State Guard. On February 1, 2013, 18 days after the Russian government completed the aforementioned acquisition of rights to 20% of U.S. uranium supplies, Hillary Clinton stepped down as Secretary of State. In addition to brushing off scandals that suggested unethical, if not criminal, behavior, as she had all her life, she had presided over one of the most disastrous foreign policies of any Secretary of State in U.S. history. Her reckless advocacy for intervening in Libya, where she supported the Muslim Brotherhood and other known terrorist groups seeking to overthrow Gaddafi, was a direct cause of the refugee crisis engulfing Europe and spilling over into the United States. Back in 2011, Gaddafi himself warned of precisely that outcome if he were deposed. He was right, but Hillary's policy in Libya was just one example of a pattern supporting the toppling of oppressive regimes in the Middle East without regard to who would replace them or whom the United States would be supporting in doing so. She left a classic vacuum. The same year Hillary stepped down, President Obama appointed James Comey to replace Robert Mueller as FBI director. There is plenty of reason to believe the relationship between Obama and Clinton never really improved after their bitter fight for the 2008 Democratic nomination. But even when the players don't like each other, they close ranks when it comes to protecting their fellow swamp creatures. Comey, a convenient Republican at that time, was one of them. He could be counted on to defend the status quo and the deep state against any external threats. Just as Hoover would spy for Democratic or Republican presidents when it suited his personal agenda, J. Edgar Comey's abuse of power crossed party lines. And like Hoover, Comey seems to have an insatiable appetite for public acclaim, whether deserved or not. His press conference on Hillary's emails wasn't the first time he elbowed his way into the spotlight. Way back in 2007, when Attorney General John Ashcroft was on his back in the hospital, Comey made a spectacle of himself by rushing to the hospital, sirens blaring to Save America. White House counsel Alberto R. Gonzalez and President Bush's chief of staff, Andrew H. Carr Jr., were in the intensive care unit trying to get Ashcroft to reauthorize President Bush's domestic spying program. Comey wanted to prevent this because the power of the attorney general had been transferred to him while Ashcroft was ill. Once appointed FBI director by President Obama, Comey was the good little deep state soldier any sitting president would hope for. When the Uranium One story broke in 2015, did Comey let anyone know about the FBI's informant and the evidence of money flowing directly from the Russian government to the Clinton Foundation? No. When Attorney General Eric Holder ordered an investigation into the IRS's targeting conservative groups to unfairly revoke their tax-exempt status, the results of the investigation sounded eerily like those of the Clinton email investigation. There was nothing that rose to the level of criminal behavior as far as the FBI was concerned. Could the FBI have put together a case against a member of the Obama administration for any one of several illegalities? Their answer was apparently no, even if they had caught one crook red-handed. The intent was to defend the machine, the apparatus, made up of millions of federal government employees who retain their jobs regardless of who was elected by the people. After residing in the swamp for so many decades, their goal is to guard the swamp and protect each other. God forbid Lois Lerner from the IRS is prosecuted, especially since Lois is the one who approved the 2009 Clinton Global Initiative for tax-exempt status. The same goes for State Department employees. That just might lead the great unwashed masses to doubt whether the Washington establishment selflessly serves the public as it claims. As much as they might have disliked the Obama administration, letting Toto expose the man behind the curtain was a much bigger threat than enduring a president with a few policies they didn't like. From that perspective, what Comey, Andrew McCabe, and Peter Strzok did during the 2016 election year makes much more sense. No, they didn't like Hillary. Strzok said he was worried about her becoming president. He thought everything Bernie Sanders had said about her during the fixed primaries was true, but he preferred her to Donald Trump. Comey's intent was recently made clear when he announced during his book tour that he also preferred Hillary to Trump for president. The bogus Clinton email investigation. They didn't love Hillary Clinton, but they liked Donald Trump even less. Clinton might have been a liar, a crook, and a Democrat, but she was also one thing Donald Trump wasn't, a member of the establishment. They disliked Clinton, but they feared Trump and what a Trump victory might mean for the parasite class that had fed so long and so voraciously on the American body politic. Trump was talking about busting up their racket as more honest federal agents had done to Al Capone's mob. Trump was an existential threat to the establishment and had to be stopped. But if that's true, why did Comey make so many damaging statements against Hillary Clinton? Why not just quietly conclude the investigation with a recommendation that no criminal charges be brought, or at least follow the rules and say nothing? The first answer is arrogance. Comey and his co-conspirators were so arrogant they didn't even think Trump would win. Has there ever been a guy from real estate and then television to become president of the United States? They all thought it was a joke. They believed they could inflict some damage on Clinton without seriously jeopardizing her chances of winning. Why would they want to damage her at all? I believe they needed to maintain their own credibility. A recurring feature of Donald Trump's campaign rallies was the thunderous sound of thousands of Trump supporters chanting, "Lock her up." It even broke out at the Republican National Convention, if you remember. President Trump graciously responded instead, "Let's defeat her in November." The animosity toward crooked Hillary was not limited to the Republican Party. A good many Democrats believe she and the Democrat Party had colluded to steal the nomination from Bernie Sanders. Now we know they were right. The FBI couldn't just blow off the email controversy. They were going to have to come up with a way to appease the many millions of people who thought Clinton should be prosecuted for something without exposing her to the justice system. So they came up with the story that she had been extremely careless with classified information, but not grossly negligent. There was a reason for that. We now know that the first draft of Comey's statement clearing Clinton said she had been grossly negligent with classified information. It was none other than our Trump-hating suspect Peter Strzok who changed those words to extremely careless. Why? Because the statute criminalizing mishandling of classified information stipulates that a crime has been committed if the suspect is grossly negligent in handling the information, even if there was no intent to commit a crime. Mishandling classified information is one of the few crimes on the books that doesn't require intent, as Comey himself acknowledged in the aforementioned statement. What is the difference between grossly negligent and extremely careless? Congressman Raul Labrador asked the irreproachable Comey under oath. Comey slithered out of answering the question twice by splitting hairs over the way the question was asked. That exchange confirmed for me that Comey was dishonest. He went to law school just as I did, and he knows full well that any legal definition of gross negligence contains the word careless or words to the effect of failure to exercise reasonable care. Strzok's sly little line edit didn't change a thing. Comey's statement proclaimed Crooked Hillary guilty and then proceeded to say the FBI wouldn't recommend prosecution when that wasn't even his job. He wasn't just getting Hillary off the hook. He was sending a message. He was sending a message to millions of Americans who wanted the woman prosecuted that the rules don't apply to her. Not only would she not be prosecuted, she would ascend to the highest office in the land. I believe he was also sending a message to Hillary Clinton, just as his predecessor J. Edgar Hoover might have. He was telling her, "We know what you did. We could finish you if we wanted to, but we'd rather have you in the White House. And once there, don't you dare cross us, because we can take you down any time." It was a classic deep state move, and it would have worked if it hadn't been for one little detail. She didn't win. Chapter 9. The Liberal Insurance Policy. Peter Strzok, the FBI's Deputy Assistant Director of the Counterintelligence Division, who led both the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails and the investigation into possible Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, hated Donald Trump much more than Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton. Yes, he texted his mistress, Lisa Page, that Bernie Sanders was such an idiot that seeing his bumper stickers made him want to key the owner's car. But his loathing of Donald Trump went far beyond even that. Strzok seems to share Cardinal Comey's affectation about being a selfless servant of the people, even though he seems to simultaneously hold them in contempt. One of Strzok's anti-Trump text diatribes claimed the president appears to have no ability to experience reverence, which I, meaning is, the foundation for any capacity to admire or serve anything bigger than self, to want to learn about anything beyond self, to want to know and deeply honor the people around you. Can you believe the arrogance, hypocrisy, and self-delusion wrapped up in that one statement? And I love the Freudian slip of apparently mistyping is as I. Perhaps Mr. Selfless just couldn't get I out of his mind while expounding about Trump's personal shortcomings to the woman with whom he was cheating on his wife. Despite the assurance he shared with everyone in that corrupted organization, Peter Strzok still feared what he ostensibly believed to be the impossible, a Donald Trump victory. And that's when the idea of an insurance policy was born. For the record, here is what Strzok texted. "I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way he gets elected, but I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before you're 40. There are Strzok's words as clear as day, and no amount of fake news media spin can change them. What could an insurance policy mean other than a way to derail or incapacitate the Trump presidency in the unlikely event he won. Think about the insurance policies you yourself carry. Why do you have them? Not to prevent something bad from happening, but to be able to better deal with something bad if it does happen. You have fire insurance on your house in case there is a fire. Do you expect to have one? No. There's a very low chance your house will catch fire. That's why fire insurance is so affordable, but you carry it just in case, so you can replace your possessions or your home if necessary, if the unthinkable happens. Buying fire insurance doesn't do anything to prevent a fire. It only helps you deal with the consequences after you have one. So no, Strzok wasn't trying to prevent Trump from winning. What he was doing was even worse. He was talking about having a plan to effectively disenfranchise the voters who elected Trump should he win. Forget democracy. Those voters whom Strzok doesn't like are idiots, remember? He said so himself in one of the texts to his mistress. If his candidate of choice didn't win, he was going to abuse the power entrusted to him to ensure that it didn't matter. If the unthinkable happened, his insurance policy would help deal with it. The insurance policy was the Russia collusion investigation. Who really hacked John Podesta's email? You may have trouble remembering how this all started. It began with the WikiLeaks release of a trove of emails from John Podesta's account, which contained emails from Hillary Clinton, or email chains containing emails from Hillary Clinton, which, among other things, showed what a phony liar and hypocrite she was. The important thing to remember is that everything WikiLeaks released was a primary document. It was Hillary Clinton, in her own words, in context, firsthand. To date, there has been no proof WikiLeaks accounts were doctored. Regarding WikiLeaks, at least one credible source says it wasn't even the Russians who hacked Podesta's emails. As reported by The Nation, a hard-left progressive publication, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, has independently analyzed the forensic data and concluded there was no hack at all. VIPS is made up of veterans of the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and other agencies. This isn't a group of bozos on the internet. They're serious people, and they pointed out that the data in question had been copied at too high a rate of speed for it to have been done over the internet. They said the speed with which the data had been copied was typical of copying data directly to a thumb drive. They also said that evidence showed the data had been copied on the East Coast. Now, I'm not a computer expert, and I certainly don't intend to imply Vladimir Putin and the Russian government weren't up to no good regarding our elections. There is other evidence that they have been at it since 2014. But I will say this. The Nation offers the only evidence to back up any conclusion about what happened to John Podesta's emails. All the anti-Trump intelligence community has said is, trust us. Sorry, boys, I'm going to need more than that. Even if the Russians did indeed hack John Podesta's email account and give the information to WikiLeaks, no Russian interference affected the outcome. That brings us to the dossier. Fake intelligence, the dossier. We now know, thanks to the memo by the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, which wasn't substantively refuted by the Democratic attempt to spin the same information a different way, that the FBI requested and received a FISA court warrant and three subsequent renewals to electronically surveil Trump campaign volunteer Carter Page. This was based on a dossier compiled by a foreign agent, funded by the DNC, and the Hillary Clinton campaign that was so outlandish that even most of the Trump-hating fake news outlets excoriated BuzzFeed for publishing it. Although the dossier was not credible enough even for the Washington Post, it was somehow credible enough to obtain a warrant from a secret court to spy on a private U.S. citizen, Carter Page. Suffice it to say, it was an unsubstantiated narrative to imply the Kremlin might have leverage in the event Donald Trump was elected president. The basis for that implication? That Trump had been set up with prostitutes during a visit to Russia. Not content to leave it at that, the authors threw in that prostitutes peed on Donald Trump, a known germaphobe. Cardinal Comey said he didn't know of the story's accuracy, but he believed it was possible. As I've said before, it's possible. And it's possible Martians were in that room peeing on the prostitutes, too. Maybe we should start a new investigation. Are Martians colluding with the prostitutes to make the president look bad? No major media outlet published the dossier besides CNN and BuzzFeed amid condemnation by all their anti-Trump media colleagues. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of legalese, but allow me to take you into the courtroom with me for a moment. There is a rule of evidence, Rule 403 in federal court, which deals with this kind of information being admitted as evidence into a court of law. It says the court may exclude evidence if its probative value is outweighed by, among other things, its prejudicial value. What does that mean? It means that if the evidence would tend to prejudice the jury against the defendant much more than it would tend to prove he committed the crime, the evidence can be excluded. Whenever extremely salacious evidence is offered in court, the defense attorney will object. And for anything as outlandish sounding as what was in that dossier, that objection would be sustained every time. Now, it's true that the burden for obtaining a warrant is much lighter than for getting a conviction in court. An investigator need only show probable cause to believe that a crime was committed. There is no need to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, but obtaining a warrant still puts a rigorous burden on the applicant. The judge starts from the fundamental position that a wiretap warrant is at the very least an assault on the Fourth Amendment, which must be overcome. The FBI must truthfully present evidence and not mislead the court. Here, it failed to fulfill that responsibility. It withheld a most important piece of information in obtaining the FISA warrant, that the dossier, compiled by a former foreign spy, was paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC. That was important information the court needed in making its determination that the representations made in the dossier were credible. The FBI intentionally withheld that. All it told the court, in a footnote no less, was that the material was politically motivated and had been paid for by a political entity. No unbiased law enforcement agency would ever present such an application to a judge, especially the top echelon. The FBI didn't have responsible leadership in 2016 and 2017. FBI had James Comey, along with Andrew McCabe and Peter Strzok, all had a political agenda. Fruit of the poisonous tree. The whole house of cards should have collapsed the moment the FBI knew the Clinton campaign and the DNC had paid $12 million for their chief piece of evidence. To circumvent election laws, the campaign had paid a law firm, which had then paid a research firm, which had then paid a former British spy to get dirt on Donald Trump from Kremlin-connected Russians. The FBI had previously worked with that former British spy, Christopher Steele. But when it came to the dossier, it not only ignored the political motivation behind his research, it paid him an additional $50,000 to continue. Not only was this dossier used to smear the president politically, it was used to create the special counsel as the basis of congressional hearings and the reason for wall-to-wall anti-Trump media coverage. But worst of all, this known piece of political fiction was used as the excuse for further investigation, wiretaps, unmasking, and the FISA warrants in question. That makes whatever was developed because of the warrant classic fruit of the poisonous tree, meaning it is inadmissible in court. When police illegally conduct a search without a warrant, any evidence is inadmissible in court. According to news breaking at the time of this writing, misleading the FISA court and getting a warrant to spy on Carter Page wasn't the most egregious act in furtherance of this conspiracy. Although the details are not all confirmed, my FBI sources are telling me there was indeed an FBI informant working inside the Trump campaign. They also say Attorney General approval is required for this type of operation in a national campaign. That means either Loretta Lynch was directly involved or the FBI went rogue spying on a presidential campaign. Either way, it's one of the most egregious abuses of power in our lifetime, if not American history. The president is calling it bigger than Watergate. The media writes it off as hyperbole. It isn't. So was there a spy in the Trump campaign? Of course there was. Comey denies a spy was used, instead calling it a confidential human source. Clapper as much as said so on The View, suggesting that Trump should be happy they were spying. He then admits that, unfortunately, the confidential name of the informant is out, and that's reported to be Stephen Halper. Comey follows suit, saying there was no spy, and the term they use is a confidential human source. So he doesn't answer if there was a confidential human source. As Andrew McCarthy of National Review astutely observed about the investigations, the investigation of Hillary Clinton was a criminal investigation. The investigation of Trump's campaign was a counterintelligence investigation. That's an important distinction. They opened a counterintelligence investigation because there was no evidence of a crime by any Trump campaign official. Yet, even with all the additional powers a counterintelligence investigation gave them, including wiretaps, covert informants, and prosecutions of Trump campaign officials on unrelated charges in an effort to get them to testify against Trump, there is still nothing for Robert Mueller to bring to court. But the Trump-Russia collusion farce is never going to any court. First, there isn't any law in the books making the supposed collusion illegal unless you're talking about antitrust. Second, it never happened. From the very beginning, this has been a charade, a wag the dog, where the agency makes up a crime and accuses the other side of committing it, then calls in its friends to prosecute it. Meanwhile, said friends collect the cash flowing out of rotten deals made as part of creating the crime in the first place. It's all smoke and mirrors to cripple the Trump presidency. It's the claim payment for the FBI's rotten insurance policy. If it couldn't keep Donald Trump from becoming president, it was going to ensure he couldn't get any of his agenda accomplished. It would paralyze his administration with its spurious investigation of a non-criminal act that had never happened in the first place. Trump and his administration would be so busy defending themselves that they wouldn't be able to keep any of their campaign promises. That was the plan. It failed. A little over a year after Trump took office, unemployment is at historic lows. The economy is booming and ISIS has been defeated. Yes, the president might have accomplished more if this anti-democratic conspiracy hadn't fought him every step of the way. But at the end of the day, the president is advancing the agenda he was elected to advance despite the best efforts of the swamp to defeat him. Different rules for liberals. One of the reasons this charade has been allowed to continue so long is the ingenious move swamper Rod Rosenstein pulled off early in the scheme, getting Attorney General Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from the investigation. I understand the motivation behind it, to remove any appearance that Sessions' support of President Trump would influence his decisions and that he might be compromised by Russians he met. It's the same honorable intention that has motivated the president to allow this baseless investigation to continue as long as it has. Neither Eric Holder nor Loretta Lynch recused themselves, but the rules are different for Republicans. It's time to stop giving dishonorable people the benefit of the doubt. Mueller, McCabe, Rosenstein, and their frenemies in the Democrat Party have no desire to get to the truth. They don't care about protecting our Republican institutions. They're out to destroy them by taking down the duly elected president of the United States and overturning the decision of millions of voters who put him in the White House. Their agenda is to get Trump out, reverse his policies, and replace him with someone who will resume the failed establishment policies so resoundingly rejected at the polls in 2016. The FBI director is not elected. He is appointed by the president, one of only two elected members of the executive branch, and reports directly to the attorney general, also appointed by the president. It's time to stop playing nice with these miscreants. If Jeff Sessions won't prosecute the conspirators, then the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein needs to call for a special counsel. Since he won't do that because he wrote the memo saying Comey should be fired, how can he run an investigation into the president for the firing of Comey, which he recommended? He should be a witness in the case. The only way out is for Sessions to be fired by the president for taking a job he knew ahead of time he couldn't do. Comey, McCabe, Strzok, and of course their fellow swamper Hillary Clinton should all be under investigation. And since Rosenstein signed off on the FISA warrant application, he should be a defendant too. Unlike Mueller's current witch hunt, the facts already made public about these conspirators call for a serious grand jury investigation. I think you already know what my recommendation will be when the evidence is in and their guilt proven. Take them out in cuffs. Chapter 10. The Lying, Leaking, Liberal Swamps Secret Court. Many Americans today may not realize this, but the FISA court was created out of outrage over the intelligence community spying on U.S. civilians. After Watergate, the Church Committee was formed in the Senate to investigate the Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Internal Revenue Service. In other words, to investigate all the same agencies Obama weaponized against conservatives and determine how much evil they had been up to under Nixon. Yes, the swamp existed back then too, and it was just as out of control as it is now. I don't begrudge the original intentions of the committee being honorable, but you just can't ask big government to reform itself. That's one of the reasons we elected Donald J. Trump. Somebody from the outside had to come in and take on the establishment. Reform is just another word for cover your ass. The secret rubber stamp. So, after a lot of grandstanding, bloviating, and camera mugging, what the swamp really did was legalize domestic spying. It created a secret court where the FBI and other deep staters could bring evidence to a judge and get a rubber stamp to spy on whomever they wanted. If you think that's an exaggeration, just look at the numbers. between 1979 and 2014, that star chamber reviewed more than 35,000 warrant requests to engage in electronic surveillance. And do you know how many were denied? 20%? 10%? 5%? 12. Not 12%. 12 total applications out of more than 35,000 were denied. If that's not a rubber stamp court, what is? It makes you wonder, is the FISA court really catching terrorists or simply invading the privacy of American citizens? Don't forget who was writing this book. I was a prosecutor for most of my professional life. I also served on the bench as a judge. I'm not some law enforcement-hating hippie. Far from it. If anything, I'm inclined to be biased the other way. But I also respect and understand the reasons for the constitutional protections we have under the Bill of Rights to our Constitution, especially the Fourth Amendment. The adversarial process I referred to earlier is intended to protect the innocent. The reason the Fourth Amendment was written was to prevent searches and seizures without probable cause. Why is the FISA court secret? There is no reason the FISA court needs to be secret. Of course, we must protect national security and sources and methods when appropriate, but a secret court is not necessary. We have just witnessed what happens when politics and deep staters use that court for their own benefit. The secrecy of the court cannot be used as an excuse by people trying to cover up their abuses. As a judge presiding over narcotics cases, if I had an undercover officer who was still on the street, I would order the courtroom closed to prevent disclosure of an undercover status and to make sure that the testimony was private. That way, I could get to the bottom line and still protect the safety, security, and life, literally, of the undercover cop. But we didn't have to set up a secret court system to do so, one that is unaccountable to the public and most of the public's elected representatives. The same is true of the FISA court. It could use the same methodology, but it doesn't because it is really a circumvention of public accountability whereby the same players keep supporting each other, get their warrants, and do whatever they want. Why did the FISA court judge, who was presented with the sealed dossier, simply accept it without establishing its reliability? There's got to be a reliability test, a credibility test. When considering a warrant application, there is no defense attorney present to make that objection, which is why the judge must be especially attuned to it. The fake news media tell us the FBI is off the hook because it told the FISA court judge the report was politically motivated and paid for by a political entity. Okay, who? Have you ever heard such question begging? How could any honest judge hear or read that and not ask the warrant applicant who the entity was? Who paid for the information to be gathered? What was the political motivation? Knowing now the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC paid for the farcical hit piece, it's hard not to conclude the court was engaging in willful ignorance when reviewing the warrant application. And don't tell me the FBI was protecting sources and methods by withholding the identification of the parties involved. We now know that Strzok, McCabe, Comey, and Rosenstein were part of the application process. So why was there no more probing into the source of the dossier? Why didn't the FISA judge inquire further regarding the dossier? And even after all the publicity about the dossier, why is the FISA judge who signed the warrant not demanding answers? Could the answer be in the text messages between Strzok and Lisa Page, where they discuss the need to connect with a federal judge under the cover setting of a dinner party? Isn't it curious that U.S. District Court and FISA Court Judge Rudy Contreras, who took Michael Flynn's guilty plea, was recused almost immediately afterwards? Dinner and a warrant. I can't read the mind of the judge who issued the quarter-page warrant, but I certainly can read Peter Strzok's texts about his relationship with Judge Contreras. We found out in March that not only did Strzok and his mistress hate Donald Trump enough to want an insurance policy against his presidency, but Strzok knew Contreras was on the FISA court and discussed setting up a meeting with him while still actively involved in the investigations of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump 6 months before his fateful interview of Michael Flynn. I point out that we found this out in March because those were texts that had previously been hidden from congressional committees investigating the FBI's activities. Here we have the life and career of a decorated general ruined for lying to the FBI about something that isn't even a crime, while the agency he is convicted of lying to defies a congressional subpoena. The FBI redacted the text messages between Strzok and Lisa Page in which they discussed setting up a meeting with the judge, acknowledged the clear impropriety of such a meeting, and conspired to set up a dinner or cocktail party to deflect attention from the clear conflict of interest. Contreras was recused from the case within a few days after Flynn took his plea. Why? We don't know. We're not even sure, as of this writing, if he recused himself. There are too many questions surrounding what went on leading up to the surveillance orders that underpinned the special counsel's investigation. And we may never get answers, not when it concerns the swamp's secret court. Chapter 11. The Lying, Leaking, Liberal Witch Hunt. President Trump has called Special Counsel Mueller's investigation a witch hunt, almost from its very first day. And, as on so many other issues, time has proved him right. Our ancestors used to hunt and burn witches for a variety of reasons. Some believed the victims, usually women, had occult powers they used to cast spells on their enemies and do evil upon the community. Others merely used the charge of witchcraft to settle scores or eliminate competitors. That the crime the witch hunt was investigating wasn't even real didn't help the victims. Once the hysteria started spreading, the mob would have its blood regardless of the evidence. I couldn't imagine a more perfect analogy for Mueller's investigation. Fall Guy Flynn. Perhaps the most tragic development in this witch hunt is the conviction of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who lied to the FBI about a conversation he had with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Why Flynn lied, only Flynn knows. Whether his answers even amount to lying to a federal agent may also have been a matter of debate before he took the plea. Flynn has been a government employee for virtually all of his life and can't afford the attorney fees Paul Manafort can. They may have advised him to just plead guilty and end it. If that's true, it's very sad. The double standard is so striking when comparing Flynn's case to Andrew McCabe's. For McCabe, there are members of Congress saying, "Call me, Andy. I'll put you on staff for a couple of days so you can get your pension." Andy McCabe gets the sympathy of the nation, while a guy who put his life on the line and fought for all of us gets a conviction. It's crazy. And there are FBI agents who don't think Flynn lied. Flynn may also have been trying to protect his son Michael Flynn Jr., who has also found himself in the crosshairs of the special counsel. Flynn Jr. worked for his dad's consulting firm, and the special counsel is interested in him for, you guessed it, not complying with the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA. Suddenly, this law that has produced a few dozen convictions in the entire 80 years of its existence figures prominently in the investigation of four different people associated with the Trump campaign or administration. Meanwhile, the rest of the lobbyist class in Washington effectively ignores it. Going after Flynn Jr. is just another standard prosecutorial tactic in trying to pressure a defendant to give up information on a person in the prosecutor's crosshairs. Judge T.S. Ellis said as much in the Manafort case. You don't really care about Mr. Manafort's bank fraud. You really care about getting information that Mr. Manafort can give you that would reflect on Mr. Trump and lead to his prosecution or impeachment or whatever, the judge told federal prosecutor Michael Dreeben. Prosecutors in federal cases are known for pitting brother against brother, father against son, family members against loved ones. It's how they do their dance. It's a very dirty dance. Up to that point in Mueller's witch hunt, we'd had a nobody punk, George Pipsqueak Papadopoulos, drunk in a bar, talking out his backside, who was completely ignored by the Trump campaign and later pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about what he said in the bar. Then we had Manafort, who was under investigation for activity regarding his consulting with foreign governments, but completely unrelated to his work with the Trump campaign. Finally, we have a war hero who was railroaded into a guilty plea for doing precisely what Andy McCabe did, the latter on a much larger and more sinister scale. And not even one of these three had pleaded to anything remotely related to colluding with the Russians to undermine the presidential election. The 13 Russians. That's when Rosenstein announced the indictment of 13 Russians who allegedly tried to influence the election with phony Facebook ads and posts. And what does the indictment allege? That the Internet Research Agency used deceptive means to buy social media advertisements and eventually organize rallies in the United States that almost no one attended. The left-wing blog, Moon of Alabama, has long maintained the campaign was little more than a for-profit venture seeking to make money on clickbait media, provocative headlines that induce people to click on the link and thereby be exposed to advertising and other revenue-generating content rather than a serious attempt to influence the election. Right-wing blogger and former director of the Office of Management and Budget for the Reagan administration, David Stockman, called it a comic book indictment that nailed a great big nothing burger, citing the ridiculous broken English wording of many of the ads and the infinitesimally small number of people who attended the rallies. Most importantly, Rod Rosenstein himself stated during his news conference announcing the indictment, "Now, there is no allegation in this indictment that any American was a knowing participant in this illegal activity. There is no allegation in the indictment that the charged conduct altered the outcome of the 2016 election." As with all these reveals, this was perfectly timed. This announcement was on less than 45 minutes' notice. Now, for the special counsel, especially in a case of enormous political and national interest, to alert the press that in less than 45 minutes they were holding a press conference for an indictment like this is more than unusual. So, they indict 13 Russians whom they know will never stand trial, let alone be extradited, arraigned, or even arrested. Putin will never allow them to be sent here to be part of Robert Mueller's sideshow. The special prosecutor's office admits that even this has nothing to do with the Trump campaign or administration. There is no evidence any American, much less anyone in the Trump campaign, knowingly participated in any of this. Now, as a prosecutor deciding whether to continue to pursue a case, you weigh priorities, resources, and interest. The interest here is high.